Hello, welcome to another episode of Turkey Book Talk. I'm William Armstrong. In this podcast, I talk to authors about newly released books on Turkey and its neighbourhood. You can subscribe through iTunes, Podbean, Stitcher or Acast, like the Facebook page or follow the Twitter account at Turkey Book Talk, and check out show notes and various other links at armstrongwilliam.wordpress.com. Remember, there's a special offer for Turkey Book Talk listeners courtesy of Hearst Publishers. You can get a 33% discount plus free delivery on any one of five excellent books published by Hearst. Check it out via the address hearstpublishers.bigcartel.com. That's hearstpublishers.bigcartel.com. Purchasing through that deal is cheaper than Amazon, and it also is a good way to directly support Turkey Book Talk. Books included on the list are written by authors who have featured on this podcast at some point. They include The Circassian, A Life of Eshref Bey, Late Ottoman Insurgent and Special Agent by Benjamin Fortner, The New Turkey and Its Discontents by Simon Waldman and Emre Çalışkan, The Poisoned Well, Empire and Its Legacy in the Middle East by Roger Hardy, Out of Nowhere, The Syrian Kurds in Peace and War by Michael Gunter, and Jihad and Death, The Global Appeal of Islamic State by Olivier Roy. To order any of those titles for a third off, plus free delivery, visit the page for the offer, hearstpublishers.bigcartel.com, and help support Turkey Book Talk. Another way to support, if you enjoy or benefit from this podcast, is through my Patreon account, which lets you make a small or large donation on a per episode basis. The standard donation is $3 per episode, but you can contribute as much or as little as you want, and you can find details of that Patreon account through all the Turkey Book Talk pages. But now let's crack on with this latest episode. In it, I speak to Soner Çağaptay. He's the director of the Turkey Research Programme at the Washington Institute think tank and the author of The New Sultan, Erdogan and the Crisis of Modern Turkey, which was recently published by IB Taurus. The book gives a brief account of Turkey's modern history, describing how Erdogan rose through the ranks of Turkey's turbulent politics from the 1970s to today, and detailing the grim state of crisis ongoing in the country, particularly since last July's military coup attempt. Çağaptay has been criticised for inconsistency after publishing a book just 3 years ago, optimistically titled The Rise of Turkey, but I think in this one he gets the balance just right in describing how things have got to where they are now. I started by asking him to outline what he was setting out to achieve with this latest book.
The book is really, I think it tracks my scholarship in the last 15 years when I have been a fellow at the Washington Institute. And before that, you know, when I did my PhD at Yale, I followed Turkish politics and wrote about it. So I've been a student of Turkish politics for the last 20 years. And the book traces a lot of my scholarship in the last decade and a half in the sense that it really follows my previous book, The Rise of Turkey. In that book, I looked at Turkey's a pretty dramatic economic transformation under Erdogan. And it's a story I wanted to write and get out to the broader global public, that Erdogan basically lifted many Turks out of poverty, that when he came to power in 2002 and 2003, Turkey was a country of mostly poor people. And thanks to him, it has become a country of mostly middle-income people. And I said, he's made that transformation. Now he needs to take it to the next level. So Turkey is not stuck in middle-income trap. It can become an advanced economy. And I said, the key to that goes through having a liberal democratic constitution, a constitution that would end Turkey's perennial tensions along the lines of secular versus religious, providing, for instance, freedom of religion for the pious and freedom from religion for the secular at the same time, simultaneously, so that these tensions over the role of religion in society would be resolved for once and for all. And then I also said in the same constitution, you could also have broad rights for the Kurds, which would end Turkey's fight with the Kurds domestically, tensions with the Kurds in the region. And relieved of all these tensions, Turkey would soar because it's no more kept down by these simmering political problems at home and in its neighborhood. So, William, I don't think Erdogan read my book, which is why I wrote this one, because, you know, as this one looks at Turkey's deep crisis that Turkey's in. And so the question is, I decided to write this book because I was very deeply worried last year, this is before the coup happened, that Turkey was marching into a crisis, and the coup actually confirmed some of my worst fears. And that's why I decided to move fast forward with it, because I think that Erdogan's political trajectory has thrown Turkey into a deep crisis.
The last book was published in, I think, 2014, was it?
Yep, correct.
And it was criticised at the time, including by myself, actually.
I remember, yeah.
For being kind of too optimistic. And really, this course that you chart in this book about you know, the crisis of the Turkish state was always was already underway at that point. Do you think that the signs were already there, or the writing was already on the wall? And to kind of, at the time, to suggest that there was an option, really, that it could go either way, it was a bit too optimistic.
Yeah, I think some of the writing was already on the wall, as I argue in the New Sultan. I think that Erdogan's political upbringing and political career in secularist Turkey deeply defined his trajectory, even after he came to power, in the sense that I think he felt profoundly marginalized, growing up pious and poor in what used to be a staunchly secularist society, in which religion was relegated to the private sphere, and people like Erdogan and his family were not comfortable with that. I think he felt marginalized because of the fact that in the secular society, people like him oftentimes received what was considered second-class citizen treatments. For example, the school he went to, Imam Hatip School, although it was publicly funded, basically when Erdogan studied at that school, allowed him only to go study theology, and he was made fun of a number of times, as I argued in the New Sultan, being told that he could only become someone, his only job could be that he could wash the body of the dead, meaning a job that's traditionally reserved for the clergy in Islam. So I think he felt profoundly marginalized growing up. And I think that frustration was in there. It was part of his political ambition to come to power and to represent people like him. I think where Erdogan went beyond what I argue for in the rise of Turkey is that, yes, he did turn Turkey into a middle-income society, but he failed to bring forward a liberal democratic society because he carries so much of his past in himself, in the sense that he not only wanted to, I guess, politically make things even for the pious conservative half that supports him. But now he actually wants to turn the tables around, upside down. And in some ways, I think his authoritarianism can best be understood within the background of this marginalization. What do I mean by that? He is the most powerful Turkish politician right now, arguably, since Atatürk. Even at the height of his career as the most powerful politician, he feels weak as a citizen. And I think that's Erdogan's major flaw. And that is a conclusion I reached at during the book, in the sense that I was trying to understand why he is becoming more authoritarian as he consolidates more power. I think it's because he feels that the moment he relaxes or chills down on the opposition, he'll be rolled back to Kasım Pasha, where he was born. He'll be rolled back to the other side of the track. So that's a really sad conclusion for democracy in Turkey, in the sense that it means that Erdogan can never accept dissent, opposition, and it's going to be really hard for him to come around with the idea of losing power ever, which is one of the reasons why I think Turkey is in a deep crisis, because it's governed by this very charismatic politician who is loved by half of the country blindly and who's hated by the other half blindly. And yet he is determined never to lose power, which means he's become only more authoritarian as time goes by. And I think he's also become more dismissive of dissent and less tolerant of opposition. Now, where I think my previous book and this book, Rise of Turkey and the New Sultan, connect is, in this book I was able to flesh out inflection points of where Erdogan could have made turns to the contrary, where this great story that was building around him, this narrative, how this narrative imploded. So I was able to flesh out some of the inflection points along this road, and I can mention two. One of them is EU accession process. The EU insisted that the military, which a grand arbiter of Turkish politics, sort of an institution that watched over Turkish political system to make sure that Islamist parties never got carried away. The EU insisted that the military exit politics because Turkey's EU accession could not move forward with the military's central role in Turkish politics. That happened. But then I think the EU somehow myopically failed to see that it was now supposed to play the role of grand arbiter, watch over Turkish politics, remain a strong institutional check and balance. And that, I think EU was not ready for that role and still is not ready for that role. So I think the beginning of EU accession talks, the exit of the military from politics, but the EU's inability to put itself in that role as a grand arbiter of Turkish politics was one inflection point, which I flesh out in my book and argue that that was one of the turns that Erdogan took, that his liberal turn really started almost as soon as he started the accession talks with the EU. Once he realized that talks were not going anywhere, the key EU countries, France and Germany, were not going to push ahead with Turkey's accession, he also, I think, turned away, and the liberal pivot that I pointed at in the last direction, I think, was early on. The other inflection point very quickly is the very high election threshold that Turkey has. As you know, it's a 10% threshold. It requires parties nationally to get 10% of the vote so they can be represented in the parliament. That threshold has cut out many middle-sized parties out of the parliament, parties that nearly tallied about just below 10%. And in each and every case, because of the way the election system worked out, the seats they'll be getting were allocated usually mostly to the AKP as the first party. So Erdogan's AKP has never to this date received a majority popular vote. It's run in elections in 2002, 2007, 2011, 2015, four general elections, never received 50% of the vote, but it's always had more than 50% of the seats in the parliament, and sometimes as much as two-thirds of the seats, meaning constitution-changing supermajority. So it was a party on steroids from the beginning, and I think that is one of the major inflection points in the sense that the party never felt accountable because it always had more power in the legislature than it had support in the among the population, but it didn't matter. It felt empowered to ignore opposition, ignore consensus building. So AKP's election victories became election victories and increasingly not democratic victories, because democracy is not just about winning elections. It's also about protecting the rights of political minorities once you win. And I think especially in the last 5 years, as I was kind of thinking about this book and formulating it, it seems to me to be a main driving factor.
I think there's also an issue about kind of titles, really, because the previous book was obviously called The Rise of Turkey, which kind of gave it kind of a more optimistic perspective than it actually had. Like, you were expressing some pessimism in the text, actually.
That's correct.
It wasn't really reflected in the title. And in this one as well, like, you know, you're calling Erdogan a sultan, but there's some kind of, it's far more kind of complex, as you describe in the book, you know.
It is. It is. So I think with all honesty, you know, as a writer, that writers can never pick their titles, although they have their power over the rest of their opus. In fact, I remember I just was mentioning this to my assistant. He did a new webpage for me. He said, oh, it looks like you wrote about it. 500 op-eds in the last 15 years. I said, and there's one I'll always remember. It's the only one where the editors allowed me to keep the title. And all the others, the editors picked the title. It doesn't always fit into what I like. Just to mention, because it's an interesting one, this is the op-ed I wrote for the Wall Street Journal about 10 years ago. It's called I Want My Caliph Back. A lot of my high school friends unfriended me on Facebook after that. They said, how can you write that? I said, read the article. Not the title. It was about my encounter with the former Ottoman caliph who lived in a walk-up in Upper East Side of New York City, was married to a South African Jew, drank scotch and listened to Wagner. And I met him and I said, okay, this guy, this caliph is not at all what jihadists make him into. And I wrote that piece. But yeah, I think I agree with you. I think that the title is, of course, catchy and jazzy, but the book is really more, there's more to book than Erdogan is Sultan or not. It's really about how this guy, Erdogan, born to a poor, pious family in a gritty Istanbul neighborhood, came from the other side of the tracks and took down a secularist democratic system, which its founders thought could not be torn down in 1,000 years, and how that revolution happened, how when that revolution happened, Erdogan had many supporters and allies, from the Gulenists to the Kurds to the liberals, and how he used each of these allies to persecute yet one more group and drop them once he had no more use for them and basically consolidated power, but also how at the end, because he has brutalized so many groups, as he consolidated power, he has created a very large group of Turkish citizens who loathe him, will never vote for him, and will never fold under him. So the conclusion, I guess, is that he's more of an quote-unquote Ataturk than a sultan. And Ataturk in quotes, what do I mean by that? Ataturk, you know, is when he founded Turkey as a secular democracy in the early 20th century, he shaped it after his own image. He said, Turkey, I am secular Western European. That's what Turkey ought to be. Erdogan is doing the same, in my view. Of course, he doesn't share Ataturk's values. He shares his methods. He wants Turkey to be, Erdogan wants Turkey to be Middle Eastern, politically Islamist and conservative. But just as Ataturk shaped the country in his own image, top down, using public policy, education, government resources, Erdogan is doing the same. But the crisis is half of the country that loathes him, has been brutalized by him, will never fold under the quote-unquote Ataturk model, though Erdogan wants to continue to rule the country like Ataturk once did. Another problem, of course, is that Ataturk did not have a democratic mandate. Erdogan does. Ataturk's Turkey was just over 10% literate and about 75% rural. Erdogan's Turkey is 97% literate. It's over 80% urban. Most educated Turks supported Ataturk. That's why it worked. Most educated Turks do not support Erdogan. So he's got tons of challenges. And I think the only way he can continue to govern the country like quote-unquote Ataturk is by ending democracy. And when I wrote the book last year, I was looking at this as a future potential trajectory, and I'm just deeply saddened that it's actually happening now. As we speak, he's taking steps to end democracy. He's already jailed the leader of one of the main opposition parties in the parliament, Demirtas. He's threatened to detain Kılıçdaroğlu, who's leading the protest march to Istanbul. Of course, the number of people arrested since the coup are both shocking in terms of the number number of people, but also the fact that many arrested are not Gulenist, which the government says was behind the coup. So I actually think that Erdogan's response to the crisis exacerbates Turkey's crisis further, because if he does that, the half that loathes him and will never fold under him will, of course, not accept the ending of democracy. So I am deeply worried that it could even take Turkey down to the next level. This is, I think, also a potential recipe for civil conflict. Turkey has at its share of civil conflict, including in the 1970s when the hard left and the hard right fought civil war-like battle on the streets. And I, of course, don't want to see that, but I think there are many signs indicating that the polarization is so deep that you could have similar episodes of civil conflict. And it's, of course, Erdogan's choice to end that trajectory. So I would say the way the books connect together, and to go back to your question, is I think Erdogan will go down in history as the guy who transformed Turkey politically. Sorry, who transformed Turkey economically, but also as the guy who messed it up politically, or almost messed it up politically. And the choice is Erdogan's. He still can make that choice if he recognizes that the country's polarized nature does not allow an Ataturk model anymore. And I think the time for Ataturk model has passed, not only for that reason, but in general, all over the world, the idea of social engineering from top down in the image of a leader, of course, is something of the past. And Erdogan has to recognize that. But I also argue in my book that in every Turk, there's a little Ataturk, meaning Erdogan's, although he's very much an opponent of Ataturk's legacy, Ataturk's legacy shapes the acts and sometimes methods of his detractors and opponents. And this is why writing about Erdogan as the new quote-unquote Ataturk was fascinating for me, because it explains so much of what he wants to do and how he wants to do it. But as I argue in the New Sultan, I think the time for the Ataturk model has passed. And the sooner Erdogan comes to that conclusion, the more likely Turkey will exit from its crisis.
In a way, though, there's a reason why he doesn't come to that conclusion, why he can't really come to that conclusion, because the way he sees it, he's leading basically a revolution, a political revolution, and he's trying to bring about a social revolution. And really, there's another key thing, I think, behind the calculations that he makes, and that is that basically he knows, and the people around him now know, that if they're not going to be in office, there are going to be reprisals. So it's really all or nothing. They're making this kind of very zero-sum calculation where it's either office or jail, effectively. And, you know, that really does raise the stakes enormously and makes things a lot more dangerous, because it kind of lends itself to paranoia. And I think that's what we're seeing a lot in the last couple of years.
I share your pessimism. I do. I think that so much has changed since the rise of Turkey. One of that is that the groups that Erdogan has brutalized, cracked down on, and demonized, when you add them up together, groups including secularists, Alevis, who are liberal Muslims, as you know, liberals, leftists, Kurds, Kurdish nationalists, when you add them up, they make up 50%. We saw it in the referendum. Maybe even more than 50% if we are to believe, as many people said, that the results were rigged. So I think Erdogan's deepest fear is that, yes, he has become the most unassailable Turkish politician since Ataturk, but also given that he needs to refresh his democratic mandate every 4 or 5 years or so, he's at a point where he's no more able to muster 50%, regardless of his economic growth and conservative agenda that appeals to the base and that appeals to people like him who he has lifted out of poverty and to whom he has given political power, which is why I agree with you. I think Erdogan really does not have that choice from Erdogan's own perspective, other than to become more authoritarian, because he has stepped on so many toes, locked up so many people, demonized so many groups, and brutalized so many of constituencies that I think he fears, rightly so, that if he were to ever lose power, he would be both prosecuted and persecuted, as well as putting his family in danger, because corruption allegations have been charged against not only him, but his family members. So going forward, I am afraid, William, that Erdogan is only going to become more authoritarian. Number one, because he feels deeply insecure as a citizen, although he's very powerful as a politician, that the moment he's permissive towards dissent and opposition, they could roll him back to Kasım Pasha. And number two, even if that was not necessarily there as a primary driving factor, a more relevant one is in the last 15 years, but especially in the last 5 years, since I published the Rise of Turkey, the number of groups brutalized by him now add up to a demographic plurality, if not majority of the Turkish population. I think he knows that as well. So it gives him a very deep sense of profound insecurity that he is now facing 50, maybe over 50% of the population that opposes him, and therefore he can only sustain his governance by becoming more autocratic and more authoritarian.
I want to go back to one of the more unique aspects of the book, that you you provide some kind of more detailed biographical information about Erdogan's upbringing and his political origins in the 70s, 80s and 90s. And that kind of stuff is not often included in English language sources. Could you just talk about this aspect and why it's key to really understanding Erdogan today?
Yeah, I think it's important to understand him because one of the reasons I think I wanted to write about his biography is, first, I wanted to give people a sense of political Islam in Turkey, that this movement did not come from nowhere, that it grew up in Turkey. Second, I wanted to discuss how the secularist system created its own nemesis, meaning it allowed, for example, religious education, although in a strictly secular society, that should not have been funded by the government. But the secularist governments created a religious curriculum and track for children of pious families in the hope that this would become an escape pod for pious families where they could put their kids in and the problem would be forgotten away. It didn't turn out like that. In fact, this religious curriculum of the Imam Hatip schools created a nemesis for the system, that's Erdogan, and his cadres. Turkey's population maybe is less than composed of Imam Hatip school graduates. Erdogan's last cabinet and last central committee of the AKP are about a third, maybe even higher, composed of Imam Hatip graduates. There's a very large percentage of Imam Hatip school alumni in the AKP, the top most person, of course, being Erdogan. So one of the reasons I wanted to write about his biography is about how the secular system created its own nemesis while it was trying to wish the problem of religion away, and at the same time, how Erdogan used instruments given to him by the system, democratic elections and party system, to take over and revolutionize Turkey's political system. So it was, in a way, a democratic revolution because it happened through elections, but how Erdogan was able to instrumentalize and use some of these institutions. So I wanted to write about his biography because it was a way for me to look at the background of this quiet, silent revolution that it took place and that it was in the making for many years, but also highlight Erdogan's biography. I think understanding Erdogan today goes through understanding his upbringing at a time when Turkey was a third world country, poor in the 50s and 60s. Erdogan was born in a gritty neighborhood to a poor family. So I think he felt profoundly marginalized, both in terms of class politics and in terms of cultural politics, growing up poor and pious in a secularist society which had a small middle class. He grew up in Kasımpaşa, which, as you know, is literally a stone's throw away from Beyoğlu, the city's 19th century quarter, and only a short bus ride away from Nişantaşı, the city's leafy upper middle class, old money neighborhood. So I wanted to write about that because growing up in Istanbul, of course, Erdogan was exposed to what Kasımpaşa and Beyoğlu had to offer. His father made sure that he received religious education. One of his primary school teachers, in government-run secular school, of course, encouraged Erdogan's father so he would send his kid to the Imam Hatip school. So it was really a confluence of different factors. A pious father, an interested teacher, the system that the secular government had set up to provide religious education that allowed Erdogan to receive the fire that burns in him to this day, this fire that people like him were mistreated, religion was unfairly cast away in Turkey, and his mission was to bring it to a central role and as well as to give people like him more political power. When you meet Erdogan in person, most people leave very impressed because of his charisma and the political fire that he carries in himself. I think understanding that charisma and fire goes through understanding his upbringing in Turkey. That's why I wanted to devote a considerable amount of the book to exploring that, looking at Erdogan's youth, teenage years, childhood, as well as his early political career.
Just going forward, I mean, you narrate how he rose through the ranks of the kind of precursors of today's AKP, the old Islamist parties in the 70s and the 80s and the 90s. Part of that, of course, when the AKP came to power, was that there was this alliance that he struck with the Gulenists, and the kind of mutual dependence, really, of those two forces is described in the book. I think you get the balance quite right, and
you
kind of condemn them both, really, for being responsible for the kind of mess that we have today. There's one passage that I'll just read out. You talk about how by 2011, the relationship had run its course. Erdogan had provided the Gulen movement with something that it did not have, a political party with which to defeat its adversaries. Likewise, the movement had provided Erdogan with assets that he lacked, an intelligentsia, media outlets and a bureaucratic apparatus, including the police, with which to crush his opponents. Now, Erdogan and Gulen each felt that Turkey was his to grab, and neither was willing to settle for a condominium arrangement, and what ensured was a raw power struggle. And that kind of, I think, gets it right, because it moves beyond the kind of lofty rhetoric of both sides and the ideas of principles. It was really far more of a kind of raw power struggle.
Look, I think the Gulenists were a very important part of Erdogan's revolution, together with other groups, including the Kurds at the ballot box, the liberals among the opinion makers. The Gulenists in the police and the judiciary and in the media helped Erdogan take down Turkey's secularist system. Of course, the irony of it is that Erdogan's success, I think, has been to use groups, meaning extend olive branches to a whole bunch of them, to persecute one of his opponents. And when he's done with the opponent, move on to the next group, redistribute olive branches, persecute the next one, and go down the line. So he started with secularists, and I raised alarm bells on Erdogan during the Ergenekon trials. I said, even if people are guilty, they still should have right to due process and courts.
That was like the plot against the military in the late 2000s.
In 2008, the government alleged, with the support from the Gulenists, that there was a coup plot to oust the government, and it started locking up first retired army officials, then active duty military officers, and then secularist opponents of the government in the media, academia, and even the business community were targeted, harassed, with the latter with financial audits and all of that, and targeted tax audits. But the bottom line is that when Erdogan went after his first group of opponents, the secularists, the Gulenists, the liberals, and the Kurds were actually happily helping him, because they thought that this was an important issue for Turkey to deal with. And my attitude at that time was, and still is, that even if there was a coup plot, which the prosecutors were never able to produce a full and convincing account of, that even if people are assumed guilty, they still have rights of due process and access to courts and lawyers. And the fact that these people were kept in indefinite detention for long term, and their ideas were criminalized, writing a column opposing Erdogan became equated with plotting a coup. This is actually what I call the Republic of Fear. It emerged not this year, not in 2013. It appeared in 2008 during the Ergenekon trials. The idea that ideas could be equated with coup plotting and people could be jailed for writing about those ideas was pushed forward by the Gulenists with Erdogan's approval and with the liberals also behind it. And it was used to prosecute and persecute his secularist opponents. That was a very important win, because Erdogan's main fear all this time in the last decade was the military, the secularist military, which had orchestrated a coup against the Islamist party that Erdogan had been part of, Welfare Party, in the 1990s. The secularist party, which together with the secularist courts and media, had a number of times harassed and banned Islamist parties in Turkey. That set of actions deeply shaped Erdogan's attitudes once he came to power. Just as I think his growing up in Kasımpaşa shaped his politics, his experience in Islamist politics in Turkey in the 90s, when Islamist parties were harassed, shut down, and actually moved out of power through the soft coup of 1997, in which the military played a significant role, shaped Erdogan's view of the military, in the sense that he knew that when he came to power, he had to go after the military, but do so methodically and by building an alliance. And that alliance had many groups, ranging from Gulenists to liberals to Kurds. Sort of a long answer to your short question, but Gulenists were pivotal in this alliance because they had significant influence in the police and the judiciary, so they were able to put together these cases, sometimes concocted cases, against Erdogan's secularist opponents and military officers. But it worked. The military's top brass threw its hands up in the air in 2011 when they resigned en masse. They basically said, "You win, Mr. Erdogan. We bow to you." That was the pivot of Erdogan's silent revolution, when he broke the military's back. Other institutions that had previously intimidated and harassed Islamists fell one after the other. He took over the courts, passing a set of constitutional amendments, intimidated the business community and the secularist media. And once, I think, that silent revolution came to an end with significant assistance from the Gulenists, basically, I would say 2011 was the height of it. But once it really, I think, matured by 2013, you could always already hear that Gulenist businesses were not getting the soft, juicy deals they were getting from Erdogan anymore, that this marriage was over, that the alliance seemed to be a tactical one in the sense that they were not friends. They were just allies who both wanted to take down Turkey's secularist system. Now that they had done it together, they parted ways. So you not only heard about Gulenist not getting business contracts, but you also heard Gulenist targeting Erdogan. I think the Gulenist going after Hakan Fidan, the head of intelligence, was basically the straw that broke the camel's back for Erdogan. He realized that if this movement had been so successful in wiretapping the offices of Turkey's top military, if it was able to eavesdrop into any conversation and leak it, they could do it to him too one day. So it was time for him to go after them. And I think the Gulenists at the same time realized that they had been able to take down Turkey's secular system and they did not need Erdogan anymore. There was a symbiotic relationship. Erdogan provided a charismatic leader and the party, and the Gulenists provided an intelligentsia and a bureaucratic apparatus that kind of came together and facilitated the silent revolution. And I think that symbiotic relationship collapsed after 2013. And we saw, of course, how this came out in the open, as I argue in the book. First, Erdogan goes against Gulen movement by shutting down their sanes. These are cramming schools where every Turkish kid has to go if they want to get into college, similar to Japan, where that entry exam into university is very competitive. So everybody spends their senior year in high school going to these cramming schools. Gulenists ran a bulk of them. It was a multi-billion dollar business for them. It was also their main form of recruitment of young, smart kids, poor kids, into the Gulen network, whereby they would provide them with full scholarships into these cramming schools to be followed by full scholarships in prestigious universities. So when Erdogan went after the cramming schools, the dersanes, that was the straw that broke the camel's back for the Gulen side, and they went after him. Then came the charges of corruption allegations, and what ensued was a completely raw power struggle. Not that one was or is more moderate than the other politically, but that both wanted to take down Turkey's secularist democratic system. They worked on it as allies, and once that goal was achieved, the alliance collapsed, and what ensued was a raw power struggle. If it's indeed true that the Gulenists were behind the coup of last year, there's some evidence which suggests that there were a number of Gulenist officers who were active in the coup effort. But if it's indeed true that they played a central role and a pivotal role, that would not surprise me, William, because I think the relationship between Erdogan and Gulen can be summarized by what is called narcissism of small differences, meaning the more similar and close two entities and people are to each other, the more they hate each other when they fall out. That's exactly what happened. For Erdogan, Gulen is the eternal enemy. For Gulen, Erdogan is the eternal enemy. And that hatred is deeper than what they can have for any other group in Turkey. And I think that's why going forward, this is going to be an important dynamic of understanding Turkey.
And of course, when Erdogan talks about the Gulenists, really, he is basically quite convinced that they are essentially a front organization for various kind of foreign intelligence bureaus and various dark powers that are out to basically bring Turkey to heel. And I think that sometimes we kind of think about the kind of conspiratorial rhetoric of Erdogan as being kind of instrumental and he's using it as a tactic. But I think that may well be true, but it's also, that doesn't necessarily negate the possibility that he believes it. And I think it's pretty clear that he and his advisors really do believe a lot of this conspiratorial stuff, and it's all getting channeled these days through the Gulenists. You know, they are seen as being at the very sharp end of a kind of very dark international plot to bring down Erdogan and by extension, you know, drag
that's
Turkey
correct
to chaos.
Yeah. I think a couple of things have happened after the coup. One is the gradualist in Erdogan has disappeared. You know, if Erdogan was, and it's an analogy I think Turkish readers will understand, if Erdogan was slicing Turkish democracy as if slicing a spit of döner kebab before the referendum, he was taking thin slices from it so that you didn't really realize that the kebab was getting smaller. That would be Turkish democracy. But that ended with the coup. His gradualism disappeared. He has become an absolutist in the way he's gone after democratic institutions. Very different. This has a lot to do with the fact that he is now a paranoid with a reason. They really tried to kill him. He has a right, very well grounded in reality, right, to be fear for his life. So he's less tolerant of dissent. Of course, much less tolerant of the Gulenists because he thinks they played a key role in the coup. And he's also become much less of a gradualist in the way he consolidated power. I think he's maybe arguably consolidated even more power in the last year than he did in a number of years put together before the coup. So the coup has has allowed the rise of a different Erdogan, a more absolutist Erdogan in terms of democratic erosion, as opposed to the gradualist Erdogan of the last 15 years before the coup. Another thing that has happened after the coup is I'm seeing this as a new trend of identification of all opposition as proxies for foreigners and identification of Erdogan as the embodiment of true democracy by his base. So the base believes that the coup, until this coup, Turkey's secular elites had always kind of played a proxy for Western interests, including Ataturk, who had basically, you know, agreed with Western powers by adopting Western models of statecraft, by kind of perpetuating Western dominance over Turkey, and that the coup ends that. It's the first case where yet there's one more effort to oust, quote-unquote, the people from power, and this time the people, quote-unquote, end it by getting to the streets, spilling their blood. And the narrative that has emerged since the coup is that only Erdogan embodies true democracy. Only with Erdogan, Turkey can rise as a great nation. Only Erdogan can restore the dignity of the Muslim Ummah. And therefore, if you don't support Erdogan, you're not a good Turk and you're not a good Muslim. So you can only be a foreigner or a proxy for foreigners. So that's really, I think, a broad brush stroke that paints all opposition to him as proxies for foreigners. And it's very dangerous because it's a very dangerous conclusion for Turkish democracy, which needs a healthy opposition to survive. So one of the reasons why I'm worried about Turkey, but also looking in retrospect, saying I think the new Sultan gets this right, is how the crisis that Turkey is in is getting compounded every day as both Erdogan and his supporters paint the opposition as foreigners, proxies for foreigners, nefarious foreign interests. That's basically telling that 40 million Turks who didn't vote for him don't belong in Turkey. And that's said by the 40 million that has voted for him. And I think that's why I'm worried about the potential for a civil conflict in the post-coup environment.
And you also speculate at one point something that a lot of people do. It's about this idea that an economic crisis could be what brings Erdogan down, or at least expose kind of cracks in the coalition. And often you hear this spoken about as a kind of great hope among pessimistic opposition people. But it always seems a bit unlikely to me. I sometimes wonder, I tend to think that it's more likely really that Turkey would kind of follow the Russian path, where what we've seen in Russia is that there's been this terrible economic crisis for the last few years, but it's only really strengthened the loyalty of Putin's fans, and actually his approval ratings, as the economy has crumbled, his approval ratings just shot up, because it sort of confirms this narrative that he has also about outside powers trying to sabotage the country. And of course Turkey doesn't have the natural resources of Russia, but I wonder if that dynamic wouldn't also take place in Turkey.
I think it's slightly different. I think although Erdogan wants to be Putin, Turkey is not Russia. What do I mean by that? Turkey has had free and fair elections since 1950, which means it has had free and fair elections longer than has had Spain. So it's really hard in Turkey for a leader to have just a facade of democracy and continue to enjoy wide popularity, which seems to be the case in Russia. Second, I think Turkey is so deeply polarized between Erdogan lovers and Erdogan haters, unfortunately, that polarization cuts down the society in the middle, as we have been seeing in the last few elections, in the 2015 December election, November elections, in the most recent referendum. It's always 49-51, you know, it stucks there. And it seems to me that Erdogan's popularity has maxed out, and that it's very hard for me to see that how that will grow any further at this stage, especially given that in the referendum campaign, the resources devoted to the yes campaign in favor of Erdogan far outweighed resources devoted to the no campaign, that it was not a competitive race, meaning you could make a case for yes openly and you could not do that so easily for no. You could be linked socially because you could be easily linked to foreigners, as we discussed earlier. If you oppose Erdogan, therefore you're a foreigner, you're not a good Turk, you're not a good Muslim. Despite all that new narrative shaping Erdoganism, he only got 51%. So I can't see how we could grow beyond that base. Seems to me that he has maxed out, which is, I don't think the Russian model is the model for Turkey going forward. Plus, as you said, Turkey doesn't have the benefit of or the luxury of natural resources so that it can become a rentier economy. It needs foreign direct investment to grow in the long term. There can only be so much done with government mega projects and investment. So I think that Turkey's social polarization has basically created an environment where Erdogan's base has maxed out at barely above or sometimes just below 50%, and that's the most he can do.
Suppose that one thing also that opposition folks are increasingly talking about is this question of Syrian refugees and possible citizenship being granted. And there's this whole wider question about sort of demographic changes. Part of the reason, I think, behind why Erdogan has been for years banging on about having, you know, more children, and is because, you know, he's very paranoid about the Turkish population, you know, aging inexorably as it becomes more urbanized. I wonder if you could just kind of talk a bit about these demographic changes from these kind of different angles, because there's also this question about a brain drain that a lot of people are very fearful about. No, and how could that
it's a great question.
Turkey's,
yeah, absolutely. I think that Erdogan really wants to make Turkey great again, but I also think that the way his policies are unfolding, that's not where Turkey is going to end up. So to go from Erdogan has made Turkey a middle-income society, it needs to become an advanced economy to become a great power. It's right now in what economists call middle-income trap. There are about three dozen countries that have made the transition from poor to middle-income in the last few decades. But there's only about half a dozen countries that made the transition from middle-income to higher-income in the last few decades. And those countries are in East Asia, Eastern Europe. You know, they've done it under unusual circumstances and usually with a lot of foreign assistance, as in the case of Eastern Europe. So Turkey is in a very critical place. It's made the big jump, which has which has also been experienced by about a few dozen countries. It now needs to make the next jump, which has only been experienced by half a dozen countries or so. And to do that, it needs to attract talent and keep it. So if you see educated Turks leaving the country, or educated Turks not coming back to Turkey, or if you see expats who used to live in Turkey leaving Turkey, expats not choosing to go to Turkey, that is basically guaranteeing that Turkey gets stuck in middle income trap. Because to get to the advanced economy status, Turkey needs to go from being a country whose main export is cars, which is what it is, to becoming an IT software hub, sort of a hub for Google. And you can't become a hub for Google if your educated Turks are leaving, Turks educated overseas are not coming back, or talented people all over the world who used to live in Turkey are leaving, or those who are thinking of countries to relocate are looking at Turkey and saying, that's not where I'm going to live. So if it does not have unfettered rights and freedoms, recognizing full gender equality, recognizing freedoms of assembly, association, media and expression, respect for the environment, all of these, I think, demands of this new middle class. I think if this government does not bring forward a political system that guarantees all these values, Turkey is not going to move up the ladder to become an advanced economy. So I actually think Erdogan's trajectory is kind of stuck Turkey in the middle income trap, and it's not going to move forward because in the absence of a liberal democratic environment, of course, the country is definitely going to suffer from brain drain and as well as its inability to attract and keep talent.
And just to conclude, really, I guess this is a bit of a sensitive subject, but how often do you come back to Turkey? I mean, do you worry about coming back at all? Because, I mean, you've just written a book calling Erdogan a sultan, and you know how the cycle of repression is so kind of wild and unpredictable.
And not really. Honestly, I mean, I have, unlike most other analysts who write about Turkey, I have been critical of Erdogan for nearly the last 15 years, my entire career of analyzing Turkey. I've also been very supportive of him, as I did in the Rise of Turkey, where I wrote about this dramatic, positive economic transformation, where I gave him some advice and said, now it's time to transform Turkey politically. He didn't read my book. He didn't follow my advice, whichever you look at it. So I think that I have a really good record of being a solid and honest analyst of Turkey. I have both given him the benefit of doubt, the credit, the recognition, but also the critical analysis when needed. So I guess for me, that's really not a concern. I've kind of lived in this kind of environment for the last 15 years. It's not new for me.
That was Soner Çağatay. Thank you very much to him. Don't forget, Turkey Book Talk listeners can get a 33% discount plus free delivery on any of 5 books from Hearst Publishers as part of a special offer. To check out the books available and to order using that discount, buying a book and supporting this podcast directly at the same time, visit the special page for the deal, hearstpublishers.bigcartel.com. You can also support via my Patreon account, donating on a per episode basis. Many thanks to current supporters, Celia Jocelyn Kerslake, Michelle Zimmer, Jan-Marcus Vomo, Steve Bryant, Aaron Ataman, and Andrew McDowell. Remember to rate or review Turkey Book Talk wherever you listen, which helps flag it up for other potential listeners. Follow via Twitter or like the Facebook page to stay updated with new episodes. Also email recommendations, feedback or abuse to williamjohnarmstrong@gmail.com. But until we meet again in a couple of weeks, thanks a lot for listening.